most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I'm here at my studios, at our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. As always, it's my joy to join you all week after week in this journey where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse with as much detail as possible and with Swami's message as the backdrop. We are in the sixth chapter. I think we are past the midway mark of the sixth chapter. And as we have seen so far, one of the most important concepts that is being covered in this particular chapter is that of meditation. The concept of meditation itself is very vast, but there's a specific context in which it is being discussed here. For a karma yogi, or for one who wishes to lead a spiritual life, as a sadhana, it is important to once in a while go inward, take a break from the world, so to say, to reassess oneself, to reaffirm oneself as to what is one's goal, how one has to lead the life. There may be enough distractions and pushes and pulls when one goes through life. So in that sense, it is important for this process of mananam, or to contemplate within oneself the various truths that one reads in the scriptures, one listens from the guru, or one discusses in the course of a satsang like what we are having right now. So in that sense, meditation is a very important tool and process for a sadhaka, for an aspirant, to realign oneself. And as we've seen, Swami says it is best done if it is done in a fixed time in a day. And if that time is early morning hours, the Brahma Muhurtam, it is even more conducive for the spiritual progress. So this entire chapter is about that, and we are still going through that. The verses that we're going to go through today are going to be interesting for a certain reason, but we'll come to that when we come to that. As always, we'll begin with a short summary of what we did last week, because the shloka we're going to start with today is an extension of the shlokas that we concluded with last time. We covered four shlokas, shlokas 24 to 27. 24 and 25 had one sentence that was broken into two verses. And in these verses, Krishna speaks about what must be done with the mind when one is trying to meditate. What must one do with the thoughts that arise in the mind? Because we have gone through the instructions that relate to the posture, the seat, the place, the time, and all of that. But what must one do when one is trying to meditate? And a brief of that is given in these two shlokas and the next shloka as well. The few points that we drew from that shloka are: sankalpas, or thoughts, are what eventually become desires. So the sankalpas themselves have to be given up, which means there are many thoughts that occur to us as we go through the day, and it's these thoughts that eventually solidify into desire, and once they become desire, then they begin to define the choices that we make and the way we choose to act, right? Or the way we, the places or the direction in which we choose to invest our time and energy. So Krishna says the sankalpas that eventually become desires, they themselves have to be given up. And one of the ways, as we discussed last time, is don't give too much importance to these thoughts when they arise in the mind. Let them arise and let them pass. And just like clouds don't leave scars on the sky, these thoughts, if they are allowed to just pass without we holding on to them, then least damage is done. And then he says, every time the mind goes outward, you gently bring it back to the object of meditation, to the Atman, to the Brahman, and slowly the mind will establish in the self. In fact, this is what is said in the next shloka, the 26th shloka, that every time the mind goes astray, gently bring it back under the control of the Atma. We'll come to the few other aspects of the 26th shloka shortly. Coming back to the 24th and 25th, that couplet. Then we discussed about what it means to contemplate on the self. When you say that bring back the mind to the self or let the mind be on the self, what does that really mean? Because the Brahman or the Atman, both are the same. By definition, it cannot be comprehended. It is beyond the grasp of the mind. Then what do we mean by saying that the mind must be placed on the Brahman? How can the mind think about the Atman while, as we saw, the mind thinks because of the Atman? The mind thinks because of the Brahman, because of Brahman. The Brahman and Atman is never the object. It is always the subject. And that being the case, what do we mean by saying that the mind must be placed on the Atman? One way of thinking of this or comprehending this instruction is that you think of how the self is the source of all, right? You think of how everything is born out of the self, and Swami would give many examples for that. And then when you ask who is Ramappa, who is Krishnappa, Swami would say, you will say I. Everyone who responds will respond by saying Nenu or I. So Swami would say that the same self is responding through these many names and forms. There are many ways by which this can be contemplated upon, and the scriptures give so many analogies and so many ways of arguments which can be contemplated upon, and you constantly keep thinking about it, and you will start seeing that, or it will start showing up in your day-to-day life, in the way you lead your life as well. So that is one of the ways. The other way is to constantly discriminate between nitya and anitya, or sat and asat, or atma or anatma. That discrimination of the buddhi, that also is a means by which you are placing your mind on the atma. The third, of course, is one where you contemplate on God, because Atman and Brahman, or the deity that you worship, they are not distinct. So thinking of Atman or thinking of Brahman is also akin to contemplating on the God or form of God that you have chosen as your Aradhya Devam, as they say, as the deity that you wish to worship. In fact, that is something that we will discuss more in detail today, because the shlokas point towards that. Going back to the 26th verse, Krishna uses three adjectives for the mind, and he says it is always going outward, it is restless, and it is unstable. And if you think about it, these are all standard qualities of the mind, and these are carried forward from the animal life, and to a certain extent, they have a role even in our mundane life, right? So the mind is made in that manner. These are not flaws of the mind, but these are not things that make the mind bad, but this is how the mind is made, right? So these are words that are coming from Krishna himself. He says the mind goes astray, the mind is astiram, and the mind is chanchalam. So these are the natures of the mind, but the only difference when we talk about human life is the human being has the ability to draw the mind within and place it on the Atma, because the same Lord who is defining the mind to be astiram, chanchalam, and so on and so forth, is also saying that the mind can be placed on Brahman. And this ability is there, this comes with this human birth, right? And that is what Krishna says here. So one of the ideas that we can draw from Krishna referring to the mind with these three adjectives is, start with acknowledging that this is the nature of the mind, and then you will be able to deal with it and tackle it. The 27th verse, Krishna says, or kind of summarizes, that one who controls and focuses the mind in this manner, slowly and steadily, one achieves this state. Krishna says that sukham uttamam, the highest form of happiness, comes to such a person. And then he says all restlessness or rajas is removed from the mind, and he becomes one with Brahman, and in the process of becoming one with Brahman, all flaws or kalmashas are removed from the mind of such a person. So these are the verses that we went through last time, so 24th till the 27th. The 28th is very similar to the 27th verse, with a slight difference. And there is a reason why there is a slight difference, though the the two verses speak about the same concept. So we will start by listening to the 28th verse, as always, rendered beautifully and clearly in the voice of Brother Shyam. I will play that verse for you. I'll give you a brief meaning after we listen to that, and then we will discuss in detail.
Yunjannevam sadatmanam yogi vigata kalmashaha sukhena brahma samsparsham atyantam sukhamashnute.
By concentrating his mind constantly thus, the taintless yogi easily attains the absolute bliss of contact with Brahman. So that is the 28th verse of the 6th chapter. As I was just saying, this shloka is very similar to the previous one, where Krishna explains the nature of the state reached in terms of happiness. A couple of verses back, we saw how the state was described on the basis of sorrow, right? So here, the state is described on the basis of happiness. So in the previous verse, Krishna speaks about happiness as, the happiness that is reached in this process as sukham uttamam, the supreme happiness. Here he uses the term sukham atyantam, infinite bliss. But in, these are, as many commentators point out, these are the same state. The reason why sukham atyantam is used here is only to maintain the meter, right? Sukham uttamam does not seem to be the description that fits the meter in this shloka. Because in most ways, these are the same. Or you can say the supreme happiness is that happiness which is infinite, which does not have any end. That is one way of probably looking at it, but both of these describe the same state. Apart from this similarity, there is another small difference, and that we will come to. But we'll first see what Krishna says in this verse. He says, Yunjana, practicing yoga, evam sada, in this manner always, which means whatever has been described in the past three or four verses, and even before, where Krishna speaks about how the meditation has to be done. So, yunjana evam sada, whoever practices this yoga that I'm speaking of, you could say dhyana yoga, in this manner, yogi vigata kalmashaha, the yogi is freed from flaws and impurities. Sukhena, easily or effortlessly, the word sukha occurs twice, but the first time Krishna uses it in this verse, it is used as an adjective. He says sukhena, which means effortlessly or easily or with ease. Sukham atyantam, infinite bliss, ashnute, he enjoys brahma samsparsham, caused by contact with Brahman. So in what way is what Krishna tells here is different from what he has told in the previous verse? It's a very small difference. In the last one, he had said, sukham uttamam upaiti. The bliss comes to the yogi. Here he says, sukham atyantam ashnute. Ashnute also means to attain or to reach, right? So sukham atyantam ashnute means he reaches that sukham. So previously Krishna said the supreme happiness comes to the yogi. In the shloka, he says that the yogi reaches that bliss. So which one is true? Is it that the happiness comes to him or he reaches the happiness? The truth is, both are not accurate. Both are not the right ways of describing the process. And that is why probably Krishna says both of this in successive shlokas, to tell you that neither do you reach, nor does that reach you. When Krishna says, you reach the goal, you find the peace, whenever he uses some of these statements, these are only attempts to explain the spiritual journey and put it in a manner that we see other journeys, right? When we say journey, we have an idea of how it is. And that is why phrases like, you know, you reach the goal, you find the peace, you find the happiness, or you reach the happiness is used. But truly speaking, you neither reach that supreme happiness, nor does that supreme happiness come to you. Why is that so? Because that sukham uttamam that we are talking about, or sukham atyantam, is not some place or object. That sukha that we are referring to is my very nature. I was thinking, I am a sukhi, I am a dukhi, I am a happy person, or I am a sad person, or these are happy times, or these are bad times, or these are testing times. But now I come to the understanding that I am by nature happiness. And there is nothing like being sad at all. So nothing that is physical or outside, which means everything. So nothing can take this happiness away from me. So the way Krishna is saying it is probably only to put it in a way that we usually speak, right? Even on this program, I keep saying spiritual journey, reaching the spiritual goal or attaining the spiritual goals. But none of this is accurate way of explaining the spiritual journey, because you don't go anywhere, you don't reach anywhere, you don't gain anything. Similarly, in the previous verse, Krishna had said, Brahma Bhutam, one who has become Brahman, right? But here Krishna says, Brahma Samsparsham, Atyantam Sukham Ashnute, one who experiences infinite bliss because of coming in contact with Brahman, he says. Brahma Samsparsham, one who comes in contact with Brahman. Again, you neither become Brahman, nor do you reach Brahman, you just become aware that you are already that Brahman, right? Maybe that is why in successive shlokas, Krishna puts it in these contradictory ways to say that both ways are correct. Either you say, I have reached it, or it has come to me, or I have become Brahman, or I have come in contact with Brahman. All of these are equally inaccurate ways of describing it, but it gives us an idea, right? And that's why probably Krishna is putting it in successive shlokas and making this point. And here Krishna uses the word sparsha. Brahma samsparsham, he says. The word sparsha is invariably used only for the interaction between the sense objects of the world and the senses, right? In one of the verses in the previous chapter, that is the 21st verse to be precise, Krishna had said, Bahya sparsheshu asaktatma vindati atmani yatsukham. The one who is detached from bahya sparsha, sense interaction with the outside world, enjoys the happiness that is within, right? That's what he had said. While going through that verse, we had seen the word sparsha is used for all sense objects, interaction with all sense objects, because seeing and hearing and touching, they are all forms of some way or other, we can refer to them as sparsha. Here in this shloka, Krishna is saying, Brahma samsparsham. But we know that the Brahman is not stula, it's not gross, it does not have a form. It cannot be seen, it cannot be heard, it cannot be touched, isn't it? You cannot touch Brahman, then why does Krishna say Brahma samsparsham? Again, it is, I feel, based on the way we often use words. We often say, listen to the conscience, listen to the voice within. The truth is, you can never really listen to the conscience, right? It is not like a voice with a deep baritone, nature that it speaks to you. It's nothing like that. You can never hear your conscience. It is only a feel that you have. It is only a sense that you understand that this is right and this is wrong. But we still use some of these words, listening to the conscience. And what could be the idea that is being conveyed through this term, Brahma Samsparsham, in that sense? When we speak of Bahya Sparsheshu, Bahya Sparsha, we speak of an interaction between the mind and an external object, and a certain joy arising out of it. All external objects are limited by nature. Either they perish themselves, and so can only give a limited or a fixed amount of time they can give us happiness, or after a certain amount of time or certain amount of interaction, that joy automatically diminishes. Best example is like eating your favorite sweet. Let's say your favorite sweet is gulab jamun, right? Imagine you have 50 gulab jamuns in front of you, each of them as similar to the other in taste, in shape, in texture. It has been made by the same cook. They taste just the same, let's say, right? They have the same taste, the same aroma. I eat two or three and it gives me pleasure. The 10th one will not give me as much pleasure as the first few that I had. And imagine I have to finish all the 50. By the time I come to the 50th jamun, there is, first of all, there is no pleasure. In fact, there is pain in it, isn't it? Because by nature, all objects and relationships and achievements in this world are transitory, and the bliss or happiness that is felt is never from the objects themselves. It is always from within only. And when one understands this, one begins to turn inwards. And as a contrast, right, when you say bahya sparsha, that is one of the ways that in which you are explaining our interaction with the outside world. So to kind of contrast that, we use the word brahma samsparsha. Bahya sparsha and brahma sparsha. The world is not real and eternal, so the happiness that is got through bahya sparsha is also not eternal, but Brahman is real and eternal, so the happiness that is born out of brahma sparsha becomes real and eternal. So it is only given as a way to explain, but these are not accurate ways to explain the state that is reached. So I think to present that contrast, Krishna uses terms such as these. In reality, we have to always remember, Brahman is not something to be touched. It is not something that can be held, because not only Brahman does not have a form, I am Brahman myself, right? Happiness cannot be reached, happiness cannot be got, because my nature itself is that ananda or happiness. Brahman cannot be contacted, Brahman cannot be touched, Brahman cannot be thought about or grasped, because by nature I am that Brahman, that Atman myself, right? So some of these, the way some of these are explained is so that it is with the kind of interaction that we have in the world, to put it in those same words, as I was saying, like a journey, like an attainment, like an achievement, it is spoken of. But what we are talking of is nothing of that sort. So this was the 28th verse. We'll go to the 29th verse. We'll listen to it and I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we'll discuss about that.
Sarvabhutasthamatmanam sarvabhutani chatmani ikshate yoga yuktatma sarvatra samadarshanah.
One who has his mind self-absorbed through yoga and who has the vision of sameness everywhere sees this self existing in everything and everything in his self. So this is the 29th verse of the 6th chapter. Very, very beautiful and very profound verse. Here Krishna makes a statement that he has made in one of the previous chapters about the jnani. But the same now is in the context of one who has perfected the yoga of dhyana. So he says here, yoga yuktatma. One who has his mind self-absorbed through yoga. Sarvatra, everywhere, samadarshanaha, has an equal vision. So a person who is a yoga yuktatma has a samadarsha. He does not see one being better than the other, lower than the other, more beautiful than the other, one being higher, or there is no differentiation in the vision. So that is the first statement he says. In one of the verses, Krishna had said how a jnani sees a cow, an elephant, a dog, a dog eater as being one and the same, right? This is very similar to that. So there is samadarsha. There is a samadarshanaha. He is a one of equal vision. Sarvabhutastam atmanam sarvabhutani cha Atmani Ikshate. A very, very beautiful statement. He says, Sarva Bhutastam Atmanam Sarva Bhutani Cha Atmani Ikshate. Sarva Bhutastam. In all beings, Atmanam, the self or Atma, Sarva Bhutani Cha, and in all beings, Atmani, in the self, Ikshate, he sees. Which means, the one who sees all beings in his self, the first statement, I'm sorry, one who sees the self in all beings as his own self, and who sees everything being contained in the self. Whenever Swami would speak about Jyoti meditation, right? Whenever we've spoken about meditation, I've made a mention of this. One of the techniques that Swami has approved of, Swami has advocated, Swami has said that there's nothing else you need to try, just practice this Jyoti meditation. And Swami has always maintained that Jyoti meditation is the best form, and this is coming from Swami, the avatar himself. So Swami says that this is the best form of meditation. And maybe as a small plug for something that is coming in a few weeks, in the month of June, that is the month that we are in already, this is the month that Swami set up the Vatavriksham, right? The meditation tree, I'm sorry. The meditation tree where on the way to the ad block, some of you must have been there. It's in the month of June that Swami had set up that many, many years ago in the 1950s. So commemorating that event, we are going to be having a live satsang, and we will be speaking about Jyoti meditation, especially in that satsang, right? So I'm just giving you a small heads up about that. So Jyoti meditation is one of the techniques that Swami speaks very highly of. And he would say that one of the most important steps in Jyoti meditation is, one, visualizing that same light as being yourself. You visualize it in your heart. And then you also start visualizing it as being in others. Swami would specifically say this, one must not stop with visualizing the light only in various limbs, right? That is the process that we all follow. The light is in my hand, the light is in my thoughts, the light is in my senses. One should not stop with that. Swami says that one should also see that same light as being in everyone. And Krishna clearly stated that seeing that same self in everyone is the state that is reached by one who is a perfect yoga yukta. Because when Krishna says ikshate, it is not the regular seeing. Ikshate means to see. It is not seeing through the eyes. So don't imagine that you will see some light glowing within a person. And sometimes we get carried away by the language like this. Just as I was saying, that we think that we can hear a voice literally from inside. Right? Some people might have had an experience like that, and that is a blessing of Swami, but technically speaking, it is not like you're going to hear a voice from within. The voice of the conscience is only a figure of speech. Similarly, when you say that you will see the light in others, it doesn't mean that you will literally see something glowing in their chest or something like that. It is only a sense, a belief, and a idea that is firmly established in your mind. So what is that state that we have been talking about? It is a state where I recognize my true nature, right? Now, what do I consider myself to be? Right now, all of us, I think we are all in this state. Even though we believe that whatever we have read from the scriptures, whatever we have heard from Swami, we believe that we are not this body mind and we are the Atman. But the most of the time, the way we react in the world, the way we carry out our life is, we think that this body, this mind, this personality, or if not, at least we believe that we are a Jivatma which has been traveling through many, many lifetimes and many bodies. When I recognize the Atma within as my true identity, then what happens is, I start seeing beyond my physical and individual attributes. I will not be able to recognize me as Atma as long as I recognize me as being Prem, or you as being you, only when I'm able to give up this idea that I am this body, I am this personality, I'm so and so son, I'm working at Radio Sai, I'm doing this. Only when I transcend that, I will be able to establish my identity as this self within. Only when I transcend this idea, I can recognize my true nature. In other words, only when I look beyond my name and form, can I see that I am the Atma. And when that happens, I will also see beyond all names and forms of whoever comes in front of me, isn't it? And Swami would say, the bulbs are many, but the current is one. Now I think I am the bulb. Self-knowledge is nothing but realizing that I am not the bulb, but I am the current that is the source of all light and all activity. And when I recognize that I am that current within, then I will not see another bulb and think that that's a bulb. I will go beyond the bulb and I'll think that that bulb is also truly by nature. That light is also not the bulb, it is the Atma within. So, sarva bhutastam atmanam ikshate means he will see that the same current is in all bulbs. Just like how I have to transcend my name and form to identify myself as the Atman, and when that happens, I will transcend all names and forms and I will be able to identify every person as being the Atma. The second half of the statement is, sarva bhutani cha atmani ikshate. He sees that all exist in the self. How is this true? This is an experience that we have every day but do not pay much attention to. See, when we go to sleep, when in the state of deep sleep, the entire universe vanishes for me, isn't it? The entire universe with all its pain and suffering and everything, when I'm in deep sleep, nothing matters to me. Myself is completely isolated from the external. There may be an earthquake outside, a vaccine for coronavirus somebody might have discovered, but that makes no change to my internal disposition because I have cut off myself from the world. The world does not exist for me. And when my awareness is awakened, right, then I begin to see what is happening outside. The example that I could probably give you is, it is like the olden days projector with a film that we used to have, right? That's how movies used to be projected in the olden days, reams of film. And there's a projector which kind of throws light. And this film keeps running between the light and the wall, and that's how it gets projected. Imagine that there is a war scene that is being projected, or let's say there is a scene of a football match and the stadium is filled with a few million people. They are all projected onto the wall. But where are all of them? Are they on the wall? Are they in the room? No, they are all inside the projector. They are not anywhere outside, right? There might be a million people being projected on the wall, a war scene of a few Mahabharata, as they say, so many hundreds of millions of people are fighting, but they are all not in front of us in the wall. They are all still inside the projector because the film is inside the projector, right? The moment I switch off, all of them vanish immediately. And this is our experience every day when we go to sleep. But we don't have the ability to hold on to this truth. And that holding on is only what we refer to as Jnana Nishta, staying firm on that wisdom. And when that wisdom is attained, it is not that the projector is switched off, but I will never be fooled that the people I am seeing on the screen are out there. Now when we go to a theater, there is no confusion in the mind, right? When we see a scene in front of us, let's say a few hundred snakes are being shown in the scene, we're not going to be scared that, oh, those snakes are going to pounce on me, because we know exactly the mechanism of how this whole thing works, isn't it? In the same manner, this wisdom will establish that all the form that I see are merely projections of the self. They are not something that are distinct from me. That is why this statement is to complete, this is why this statement is complete with both aspects. సర్వభూతస్థం ఆత్మానం సర్వభూతాని చ ఆత్మని ఈక్షతే. సీయింగ్ దట్ ఎవ్రీవన్ ఇన్ రియాలిటీ ఇస్ ద సేమ్ సెల్ఫ్ అండ్ అండర్స్టాండింగ్ దట్ ద సెల్ఫ్ కంటెయిన్స్ ఎవ్రీథింగ్ దట్ ఇస్ సీన్. But these are also ideas that are useful for contemplation. Right? That is why this whole thing is occurring in this point where Krishna is talking about dhyana. That is something that we've been mentioning about and seeing in this entire chapter. So when that is the case for a devotee, the object of meditation is God. If you and I, at least I can tell about myself, I'm going to sit and meditate, I'm not going to sit and meditate about the Atman or Brahman, I'm going to meditate on Swami. Right? So for a devotee, the object of meditation becomes the form of God that he or she has chosen for oneself. And the peak of meditation is when the meditator merges in the object of meditation and the process of meditation. So this contemplation also changes accordingly. That's why whatever Krishna said in this verse, when he said that every person whom you interact with, you find that the same self is there in them, and then you find that everything is contained in the self. So the same concept is going to be spoken of with respect to a devotee and God in the next verse and the verse that follows after that. And that's why the next verse is a very, very beautiful verse, especially for most of us who relate to bhakti, who relate to worshipping a form of the Lord. This becomes one of the very beautiful verses, this one and the next one. So we'll listen to this verse. This is verse number 30 of the 6th chapter. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss in detail.
Yo mam pasyati sarvatra sarvanchamayi pasyati tasyaham na pranashyami sachame na pranashyati.
He who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, he never becomes separated from me, nor do I become separated from him. So this is the 30th verse. In this shloka, Krishna speaks as Ishvara. Right? We have seen that time and again, suddenly Krishna starts speaking as the Supreme Lord. So this is a shloka where Krishna speaks as Ishvara, and in the first line repeats the same statement that he had made in the previous shloka with one small modification. He replaces the word Atma with Mayi, with myself, right? Mam, me. He says, Yo mam pashyati sarvatra. He who sees me everywhere, sarvam cha mayi pashyati, and sees everything in me. In the previous shloka he had said, one who sees the Atma in all and everything in the Atma. Here he says, he who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me. We'll come to the second statement, or what completes the statement. So Krishna is saying, one who sees like this, he is going to say something about that person, but we'll come to that. But before we do that, these are shlokas where the hint is very, very obvious. What is that hint? Whether you meditate upon the Atma and take to the path of self-inquiry, or you take to the path of bhakti and try to meditate upon God, it is one and the same. Because there is no difference between the Atma, the Atmic principle, and divinity, or any form of God that you choose to worship. In the second chapter, Krishna, while describing the Atma, had said, he had used these words, Nityaha Sarvagataha. It is all pervasive, it is eternal. Nityaha Sarvagataha. Stanuhu Achalo Ayam. It is steady and it is unmoving. Sanatanaha. It is eternal. So these are all descriptions that he used for the Atman. And at that time we had discussed that how that which is all pervasive cannot move. Right? Sarvagataha means it's all pervasive. Stanuhu means it is steady. Because that which is all pervasive, literally speaking, does not have any space to move. Because if I have something that is going to fill this entire room from wall to wall, there is no way I am going to be able to move that thing because it fills the entire space. So Krishna speaks of the Atma as being sarvagata. It is all pervasive. If my Atma is all pervading, it is, I'm saying, when I say that my Atma is all pervading, where is the space for another Atma? Where is the space for God? It can only mean that what I am referring to another Atma, what I am referring to God that I worship, that is also the same, isn't it? So all through Krishna is mentioning the same thing. When he describes the Atma, it is the same language that is being used. When he describes God, when he describes Brahman, it's the same language that is used. When he describes himself, he is an avatar. He is a form of God that we worship. The same language is used. And this is the hint that is constantly dropped, that there is no difference how you worship the Lord, which path that you take to reach this state of Sukham Atyantam, the eternal happiness that we are talking about. I'm sure we'll come back to this concept again in the later chapters, especially when we start dwelling on bhakti in a little more detailed manner. Because perfection in devotion is the ability to see God that we love in all, at all times. If we are growing in this path of devotion, it will be easier and easier to visualize and live with this belief that God is responsible for everything that is happening to me, right? That is one of the standard ways by which we have to grow in our devotion. There are two ways of devotion. I think I'll come to that towards the end if I have time. There are, Swami says there are three types or three stages in devotion. One is merely worshipping God. One is merely saying that, these are the problems I have, these are the solutions that I need. But if we're talking about growing in devotion, we begin to believe more and more that all aspects of my life are governed by my Lord, governed by my Swami, right? And when there is love, it becomes more and more easier to visualize this, that to live in this belief that whatever happens in my life is happening by the will of God. Suppose a person is being good to me, somebody else is being nasty to me. All this we consider as a way by which Swami is manipulating my life. Manipulating probably is not the right word. He's arranging my life so that I can grow. So when I interact with people, everyone will become only an agent of his divine will. No one can cheat me. No one can do good to me. No one can hurt me. No one can in any way benefit me. Right? Because whatever happens to me is because my Swami has willed it, and that person in front of me is only an agent of Swami's will. So the individual ceases to exist for me. Right? If I'm going to be established in this idea, I will not see the person in front of me as another individual, right? They all only become instruments of his will. Mam pashyati sarvatra. You will see only me everywhere. So I will cease to see somebody as my mother, my father, my relative, my friend, my enemy, my well-wisher. No, everybody is bringing to me that same Swami's love. Mam pashyati sarvatra. I will see only Swami in whatever happens around me and whoever comes to me. And everything happens within his will. Sarvacha mai pashyati. So everything is contained with my Lord. So every event that happens is happening within the circle of his will, right? So I will see every person as being nothing other than Swami. I will see every event that contains different people as also being a part of Swami's will. And this attitude is a must for the natural progression in this path of bhakti. In another way, the statement and what Krishna says in the previous statement is similar, and it is important to remind ourselves, right? And Krishna says, you see the same self in all. It is not a special power that the jnani acquires. both the statements that Krishna is making, this one and the previous one, it is not like a special vision is acquired or a special drishti is acquired. When Krishna says you see the same self in all, right now I am not able to see myself as the perfect Atma. I am not able to feel that the Atma is the same Atma is in all. But whether I am able to feel it or not, whether I am able to be convinced in that or not, this is the truth all the same. That's what the scriptures say. This is the truth. And the multiplicity that we see with and interact with is an illusion. So when I start seeing the self as being the same in all, I am not acquiring some kind of a special status or a special vision. I am only now seeing the truth, which till now I have not been able to see because of the illusion covering my vision. In the same way, when we speak about seeing Swami in everyone, it is not a special quality to be acquired. A lot of people ask, how do I start seeing Swami in everyone? Right? I'm not saying that the question is wrong or misplaced, but we think that it is something that needs to be acquired. That thought is wrong. Because the truth is, there is Swami in everyone, and I am not able to see it now in my present stage. And all sadhana that is being performed, that we do, is actually taking us towards that state of being able to see Swami in everyone. All karma yoga is, as Swami has said and Krishna repeats over and over again, is a process of purifying the mind. All inquiry is breaking down this illusion that we are all caught up in. So this tattva darshanam, the vision of the essential truth, takes place when we go through this whole process. So when we say that I see Swami in everyone, or I see everything happening within Swami, this is the truth that I am not able to see now. And when my vision is cleared, I see the truth. Right? It is not something that I acquire as an ability, or now I am, from now onwards I am going to start seeing Swami in everyone. No. If we are able to see that, which means the mind has started becoming more and more pure. So in the verse from the previous chapter that I had quoted, Krishna had said, one must give up attachment to Bahya Sparsha and develop Brahma Samyoga. Right? That is what Krishna had said in that verse, the 21st verse, I think. He said, union with Brahman or Atman within. And that was one of the first verses where Krishna hints about dhyana, where you withdraw the mind from the external interactions and turn it inward. When we operate in the world, it is very, very difficult and challenging to believe that Swami is in every person, right? Especially those whom we don't quote-unquote like, those whom we detest, those who trouble us. So this truth itself can be a form of meditation also, because whatever Krishna is saying here is also a form of meditation, a truth that can be contemplated upon. So this is also a truth that can be contemplated upon, that Swami is in everyone that I interact with. But it becomes more difficult to contemplate on this truth when you're constantly, you know, brushing with others around, especially those whom you're not having very pleasant interactions with. Right? So contemplating on this truth becomes very difficult. And that is why this can also become a form of meditation, where you take a break, a fixed time in a day, and then you contemplate on this idea that God is in everyone, and I am going to interact with God in different forms today. And make it a form of a prayer where you say, Swami, please help me in visualizing you in everyone that I come through. I serve you through my children. I serve you through my parents. I feed you when I feed my pet. And slowly extend the idea even to interaction where there is no love and there is no concern directly. Right? It's very easy for you to serve your parents and say think that the service I'm offering to Swami, or you go out and do seva and you say that the seva is being offered to Swami. Right? And these activities are also part of that upasana or worship that we're talking about. And this contemplation becomes a way by which you, as you've been talking about, you withdraw your senses, you withdraw yourself, you kind of put yourself in this cocoon where you're able to have a protected environment where you're able to contemplate this idea. And when Krishna says what Krishna says in the next line is a very, very beautiful assurance for anybody who's trying to practice this path of contemplation. he says, tasya, of him, which means who sees me in all and all in me, tasya, aham na pranashyami, I am not lost to him. Sacha me na pranashyati, and he is not lost to me. Meaning, you will not be distant from God, and God will not be distant from you. A question that a lot of people ask, how do we feel close to Swami? How can we feel that Swami's presence in our life constantly? How can we feel dear to Swami? The answer is in this shloka. Krishna says, the one who sees me in everyone, one who sees everyone in me, such a person will never be distant from me, and I will never be distant from that person. So when we start looking at this shloka, and these can be looked at from the point of view, as I said, this is only only a rephrasing of what Krishna had said in the previous verse. But this is a shloka that is meant for a devotee, right? So this is a shloka that is also like an assurance. This is a shloka that is also an indication of how one has to grow in devotion. What is that next stage in devotion that one has to go into? But at the same time, this is not at all different from the esoteric concept that Krishna spoke about previously, where he said, the one who sees the self in all and everything in the self, he reaches the ultimate state, and such a person is never distant from the self, right? So it's the same thing which is said here, but when it is said with, when the Lord says that I am never distant from you, you are never distant from me, it becomes much, much more sweeter for a devotee, because that is what a devotee aspires for, right? In this path of devotion, through love we aspire for this. We always want to be in Swami's presence. We always want to feel Swami's presence, right? So for a devotee, the bait is different, if I could put it that way. The bait that the Lord is offering is different, but the path eventually takes you to the same state. I think we'll have enough time for the next shloka as well. It is very similar to what Krishna has said in this previous shloka. We'll listen to that. We'll have a short discussion about that, and with that we'll conclude this week's episode.
Sarvabhutasthitam yomam bhajatyekatvamasthitah sarvatha vartamanopi sayogi mai vartate.
That yogi who, being established in unity, adores me as existing in all things, he exists in me in whatever condition he may be. So that is the 31st verse. The same statement that Krishna gave with regards to the vision of truth, he repeats it now with respect to devotion to God or devotion to himself, right? Oftentimes it is said that this jnana, this vision of truth when you have, is that which can, once gained, never be lost. It can never be taken away from you. It does not change with what happens to that person, what that person is going through, where he or she is, what stage of life one is going through, right? That's the whole description of that jnana. Once it comes, it never leaves. But the only thing is, this is explained in a manner that a devotee understands, right? So such a person is always in me, right? That's what Krishna says here. So these couple of verses, the previous one and this one, can be explained on the basis of Vedanta, what it means, what you say when you say that one is established in me, or what it means by saying that everything can be seen in the Lord, what is the nature of Ishvara, what is the nature of Atman. It can be spoken of this way, and I think many commentators also do so. But let us just look at these from the point of view of a relationship between a devotee and his or her Swami. Because clearly Krishna is speaking about the act of worship, or the process of worship and reverence in this particular shloka. At least he makes it very clear. He uses the phrase, mam bhajati, worships me. In the ultimate stage, there is no worshipping, right? There is no devotee, there is no God, there is no process of bhakti. because all of this merge into one. There is no question of one worshipping the other. The reason Krishna is mentioning it is probably to reiterate or emphasize on this process of worship. Mam bhajati, he says. So let us try not to intellectualize at least this one and look at it purely from the point of view of a relationship between a devotee and the Lord. Krishna says, sarva bhuta stitam, as abiding in all beings, yo mam bhajati, whoever worships me, ekatvam astitaha, established in that unity, that it is the same Lord whom I am worshipping, is established in all beings. Any devotion is not perfect until this state is reached that Krishna is describing here. When we study it, this is also the essence of meditation itself, isn't it? The Lord who is worshipped in one particular form with a certain set of attributes. Let us say that you are worshipping Lord Narasimha, right? You worship that particular form. It's a very unique form, a lion face and a very gruesome appearance. You worship that anger. We say that we worship Ugra, Ugra Narasimha we call. Or when you worship a form like Radha Krishna, you worship a more mischievous and playful God, a more enchanting Lord. Or when you worship Shiva, you are worshipping a Lord who is the master of all detachment, who is an embodiment of such detachment and dispassion. So when we choose a form to meditate upon, it is like meditating on a particular mantra or meditating on a jyoti or a particular form that we've been talking about, right? So you're choosing a Lord with a specific name, form, attributes. And what are we doing? Through that form, we are trying to access the supreme power that is behind that form. And when we transcend the name and form that we are meditating upon, we come to the understanding that the same force, the same divine Lord is behind every name and form that we come across in this world. A lot of times people wonder, you know, if God is formless and attributeless, nirakara, nirguna, why not worship God as being formless itself? Why should you give him a name and why should you give him different attributes? He sits on this animal, he holds this weapon, and why all of those attributes? Well, when we know that the Lord is beyond attributes, why give him a form that he is not? Why do we give attributes and why do we attribute name and form to God? Because the mind deals with attributes. The mind can only interact with a name, form and qualities. And this whole process of meditation is you are trying to draw the mind from the interactions with the outside world and you are trying to engage the mind in what we were speaking of as Brahma Samsparsha. We are removing it from Bahya Sparsha and we are trying to make it interact with something more purer, more noble. Right, and the nature of the mind is the mind has to interact through names, forms and attributes. Right, and more importantly, when you recognize through this process God as being beyond form, then this idea that God is in every being that I encounter, I think will be more easily and firmly established. Otherwise what would happen is, if I start worshipping and imagining or contemplating on the idea that God is always formless and attributeless, I think it will become even more easy for me to reject a person in front of me as being human and there is no God in that person because there is a form. With a form you cannot be God. But if we are taking a name and form and we are able to meditate upon that name and form and then eventually transcend that name and form, any name and form, a person who comes in front of me, it could be a relative, it could be a friend, or it could be an enemy. He comes with a name and form and an attribute. I can look beyond that and look at the divinity within. Right? And that is why this process of reaching the absolute through a form becomes very, very critical. And that leads to the state that Krishna is speaking of here. Sarva bhuta stitam यो माम भजते एकत्वम आस्तितः, ही हु बीइंग एस्टैब्लिश्ड इन यूनिटी अडोर्स मी एज एग्जिस्टिंग इन ऑल थिंग्स. एंड देन ही सेज स योगी मई वर्तते, सच ए योगी रिमेन्स इन मी सर्वथा वर्तमानः अपि, व्हाटएवर बी दैट पर्सन्स प्रेजेंट स्टेट ऑफ एग्जिस्टेंस. He may be healthy or sick, rich or poor, he might become a sannyasi, he might be a grihastha. Whatever changes happen to the physical status or physical state of living, he will always remain in the Lord. None of these changes will affect this relationship. Why? Because even death cannot take away the state from that devotee, because that devotion or this relationship is not based on any name and form or any such form of change, right? So that's why in these two shlokas, Krishna very beautifully makes this whole idea of meditation or contemplating on the Brahman more real for somebody like us, who is more related, devotion is more relatable to us, contemplating on Swami is more relatable to us. This is actually a very essential progression in bhakti itself that Krishna speaks about, Swami has also spoken about in other discourses. Maybe the next week we will start with that, what these two verses stand for. I think we are running out of time, so we will not go into that. So we'll next week start with this idea of what these two verses stand for, the three stages that Swami speaks about. I in fact did make a passing reference to it even during last week's episode, but we'll start with that next week. So thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. Do join me again next week for the resumption of this triune pilgrimage. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. In a short while from now, Brother Bishu will be with you for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next week at 7:30 p.m. Take care, stay safe, Jai Sai Ram.